Blog Talk Radio. Hello and welcome to the October 30th, 2011 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard. It's the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics I have planned today, which is our first time appearing on Blog Talk Radio. And to be truthful, it was hard connecting up to the last second. I had a little glitch here, so I'm a little bit out of breath starting the show barely on time, so bear with me here. Now, first, what I have planned is to discuss the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs, which I just finished reading this afternoon. I'm going to discuss why I recommend it and also a lot of the things that I took away from it. And if you're reading it or if you have some perspectives on the information that I've gleaned from it, I look forward to hearing that. Then probably in the next hour, we'll talk about Occupy Wall Street's rap sheet and how it proves that they are nothing like the Tea Party, either in action or in ideology. And third, all the latest on the Middle East, all the bad news over there, particularly focusing on Afghanistan, Syria, and our so-called friends in Saudi Arabia. Herman Cain, we see he's starting to take the lead over Romney in some of the key polls, despite his recent missteps. And so we'll talk about that. And then what do you make of the smoking commercial that he put out there in the universe? And we've got more planned if there's time as well. Before we dive in here, some logistics. This is a new platform for me, so we'll have to see how we do with this. But, of course, the first way to get in touch with me is through the guest call-in number. It's 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. You can connect to that, I think, via Skype as well, which is maybe cheaper for some people depending on your calling plan. We also have a chat room. And there is, actually, I've just opened it, so it may not have appeared until now. It says there are three users, so I think some people are in there. It is a moderated chat room, so we'll see how well I can keep up with and talking to you about the subject matter. But I believe, unlike my prior platform, you guys can all see the comments from each other as well as just me seeing them. I will try to keep up with the pace there. It just depends how many in the chat room and commenting actively and where we are in the discussion. But do also, like I said, call in live, either using your phone or you can connect via Skype, and that would be great. The phone number again is 760-888-5817. So with that out of the way, let's go ahead and dive in. You know, again, I just poured through this week the Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs, and I do recommend it as a biography. I don't consider myself necessarily qualified to review it and compare it to a lot of other biographies. I haven't read other biographies for a long time, but I can tell you what I did enjoy about reading this book. I do like that Isaacson divided it into chunks in the different chapters that were more or less chronological, but then he would depart from the chronology in order to, complete a topic or just talk about how it tied in. Sometimes you would find that because he would go subject matter by subject matter, and, you know, he would kind of revisit something that he'd said before, and you say, okay, well, I already read that before. It wasn't too frequent and it wasn't very annoying. I liked his tone. I liked the sheer amount of information in this book. And of course, I really enjoyed, you know, hearing all of this information about Jobs. Jobs himself, towards the end of the book, we learn that he had wanted this biography to exist. And I think you'd heard some of this before. He wanted the biography to exist because he wanted his children to know him. But as I suspected might have been the motivation, he also said that he wanted to have what you know, what he thought on the record out there before other people started writing stuff about him after we died. I mean, after we died, after he died. Those of you who are familiar with some of the biographies or semi-biographies that were written after Ayn Rand died know that if somebody writes about you after you die, you have no chance to answer them and give your own side of the story. The consequences can be bad. So I think it was good that he did this. And there is so much information. I learned so much about Apple. I learned more about the different sorts of innovations and the things that he pulled off during his life. I came to respect him more. Of course, I also learned some things that were not so great about him as well, and we'll discuss that. So the first thing I was going to say is maybe you are familiar with the book called I Am John Galt, which was written by Luskin and Greta. I think it's Donald Luskin is the primary author who we've seen go out and do a lot of interviews. And in that book, there's a chapter on Steve Jobs, and he likens Steve Jobs to Howard Roark. And I would think that that is a good and apt comparison, given, of course, the fact that none of the figures that he's going to talk about in the book, with the exception maybe of John Allison, I don't think they're objectivists, right? And Steve Jobs certainly was not an objectivist, but he certainly did have a lot in common with Howard Roark. And if you had to liken him to any of Rand's heroes, I would certainly have said that. One thing I did want to also tell Rand fans, though, is that although we had heard about that Wozniak interview in which Wozniak had speculated that Jobs was influenced by Rand, there was not a single mention of Ayn Rand or any of her works in this biography. So there's no explicit mention of Rand. And in fact, there was a book that he did read every year. How, you know, some people do read Rand's work every year, maybe Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead. Do an annual reading of that. The book that he read annually was one called The Autobiography of a Yogi by an author named Yogananda. So that's not exactly objectivism. Nonetheless, I think that he did have, like I said, a lot in common with Howard Roark, and perhaps he had a struggle within himself in terms of what I would say were very objectivist elements or Aristotelian sort of elements in his thinking and way of life, and especially his way of doing business. And on the other hand, there was this real irrational streak in him that, you know, came from early on in kind of his late teens and stuff when he was exploring the Zen and the, you know, the mysticism side. I mean, he even did a trip to India. But let me tell you about these wonderful positives about him and the way in which I thought he was like Howard Roark and like an objectivist. First, he said that the reason, you know, and actually, if you think about Howard Roark has that famous line in which he says that he is not going to build in order to have customers or, you know, clients. He's going to have clients in order to build. Similarly, Jobs had the idea that he is going to have customers in order to make great products. His whole goal was to make great products and to build a great company. And the money for him was more of a secondary concern. Now, I've got my iPad here. I've actually done the whole reading on the iPad, which was really a pleasure. And then also I was able to do all sorts of bookmarking here. So let me get you to the section that I wanted on this issue of him having customers in order to be able to make great products, that was his primary concern. And that was on page 661 of the book here. It says, and then in terms of the motivation for this, right? He says, this is talking about the phone when they're making the iPhone. And it says, Jobs and his team became excited about the prospect of building a phone that they would all want to use. Quote, that's the best motivator of all, end quote, Jobs later said. Repeatedly throughout the book, we're told that Jobs wanted to make products that he was excited about, that he and these other people that he worked with, that he respected, that they wanted to have it for themselves. That was the primary motivator, to make these wonderfully great products. So I love that theme, the fact that he eschewed market research They said, we're basically going to tell people what they want before they even want it. And that was especially true, I think, of the iPad. The iPad, a lot of people made fun of it when the concept was first introduced, even after the keynote address. Jobs could typically mesmerize people during the keynotes where he introduced the new products. And people were joking. They were saying, oh, it's like a feminine hygiene product, iPad, ha, ha, ha. And later, when people actually got their hands on them and they tested, they said, oh, my gosh, I really do have to have one of these things. And that he did that time and again, basically telling people why they need something before they even knew that they wanted it. Now, one theme that was run throughout the entire biography in terms of the way that he ran the business was this dichotomy in the tech industry between having a so-called open versus closed platform. Open versus closed. So the open platform was, of course, Windows. And Windows, they allowed the making of clones on all sorts of different computers. And they also allowed all kinds of different people to develop applications without any control over it for it because they released their source code. So it was a very open system. Jobs believed in having control over all the aspects of the consumer experience, from the hardware to the software, obviously all the design, and all the way through the retail experience, the experience that you have when you go and purchase it. Very, very much attention to detail. He wanted control over the whole experience. Why? Because he thought the products that came from the open philosophy were, he called them crappy. He used all sorts of horrible language to describe people's stuff that was not up to par. He thought that they were bad products, poorly designed. They crashed all the time. I mean, if any of you who have had trouble with Windows, like I did before I switched over to Mac, know some of the frustration that you've had. He liked to control everything from beginning to end, and he thought that that made for something that worked seamlessly, for a better computer experience, for a product that was better, more reliable. Yeah, beautiful. Now, another way that he described this open versus closed at one point here in the book is a dichotomy between something being integrated versus fragmented. And this idea of integration was talked about repeatedly. I'll give you a quotation from the book here. It says, it exemplified the great debate of the digital age, closed versus open, or as Jobs framed it. So this is Jobs' language. As Jobs framed it, integrated versus fragmented. Was it better, as Apple believed, and as Jobs' own controlling perfectionism almost compelled, to tie the hardware and software and content handling into one tidy system that assured a simple user experience? Or was it better to give users and manufacturers more choice and free up avenues for more information by creating software systems that could be modified and used on different devices? Quote, Steve has a particular way that he wants to run Apple, and it's the same way it was 20 years ago, which is that Apple is a brilliant innovator of closed systems, end quote, Schmidt, who's one commentator, told Isaacson. He says, quote, they don't want people to be off on their platform without permission. The benefits of a closed platform is control, but Google has a specific belief that open is the better approach because it leads to more options and competition and consumer choice, end quote. Jobs obviously believed that he had the right side of that dispute. And obviously, as an objectivist, where we talk about an open versus a closed philosophical system, some people have been in on that debate before. The open system, maybe there's not a good quality control going on there. If you say, well, there's a closed system, we refer to objectivism as only those ideas that Rand herself talked about during her lifetime. And you know that at least all of those represent her views, and there's no chance for mistakes in that line. So I saw the parallel there, but I do like the wording of it as integrated versus fragmented. And that strategy particularly paid off when they recently introduced this thing called iCloud, which was one of the last projects that Jobs talked about during his lifetime that I know of. There might be more that we don't know of yet, but this iCloud, where they store certain pieces of information up in the cloud and it seamlessly synced with all of your Apple devices is beautiful. And there's no way that that could have been pulled off so smoothly if Apple hadn't had control of over all these things from beginning to end. Another thing that was distinctive about him was that he was able to shuffle from abstract to concrete very easily. And basically what they would say is that he could talk about the big picture ideas and the overall concept for a project and then get down to the smallest and tiniest detail. So let me get a passage that's representative of that. And my iPad is not cooperating with me. The problem is that I also marked up so many things in this book because it was so fascinating on different levels. I have a couple different interests here. One is I'm interested in the development of the Apple products themselves. The other thing I'm interested in is Jobs' attitude about privacy. And there's some other things about his overall methodology and trying to put together what his philosophy is. There's a man named Bukes who is the CEO or was the CEO of Time Warner. And Bukes had said that he respected Jobs' ability to be both a strategic thinker and a master of the tiniest details. Quote, Steve can go readily from the overarching principles into the details, he said. Then there's another passage, and let's see if my iPad's not cooperating with me still. I'm going to now start damning Steve Jobs because I have to. Now there's a note here on 795. Yeah, some leaders push innovations by being good at the big picture. Others do so by mastering the details. Jobs did both relentlessly. Now that's just Isaacson. That's Isaacson characterizing Jobs and the way he approached his work. The idea of somebody being able to go from the big picture or the abstract to the concrete and shuffle back and forth easily shows a certain type of mind, the way that his mind works. So this is something else. Now, overall, I think that Jobs in his life could tend to be a bit platonic, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I think this does show that he did have this ability to function both from the concrete and the abstract level, that he was able to tie the big picture to details in reality to a large extent. Now, in politics, he's kind of a mixed bag. On the one hand, he was reported as telling Rupert Murdoch, that Fox News was destructive and was messing everything up. But then later, he was known as saying that... Oh, somebody's saying ironic here. Okay, I'm getting distracted by your chat messages here. Sorry, people. So on the other hand, he was talking to Obama, and he did make those statements to Obama where he warned him he was going to be a one-term president. And the reasons he said Obama was going to be a one-term president was because of government regulation and the horrible cost that government regulation imposes on business. It was easy, said Jobs, for business to open in China versus United States because of all the tremendous costs. Now, in terms of education, Jobs said that our problems in education in the United States was because of the power of the teacher unions. Government control of textbooks was something else that he cited that he disagreed with. Jobs was also a strong defender of IP, intellectual property rights, and he at one point said he was going to fight Google over one particular battle, even if he had to burn through the whole fortune that he had in order to do so. He eschewed working with committees. He denounced theft as bad, and this was part of his motivation for trying to put together iTunes, so that instead of having your Napster and your other ways of stealing music, that you would actually pay for them. He was also good at defending himself with respect to charges of censorship. There was a critic in the Silicon Valley by the name of Tate. I guess he worked for one of the journals or magazines. And he went on email back and forth with this guy and said, you know, basically I'm keeping people free from all of these horrible things. And yes, you know, he even admitted at some point that in terms of censoring content, content, so to speak. He didn't censor, obviously, only government censors, right? A businessman says, if you want to buy my product, I have certain rules about what applications can be on my iPhone, on my iPad, etc. We talked about that in this show with regard to Gizmodo's smear on Jobs. A lot of people had criticized Steve Jobs and Apple for exercising control over the content of the apps that it allows on the iPad and the iPhone. But Jobs says, no, basically what I'm doing is I am ensuring that my customers have a good experience and that their experience of using my products is not going to be polluted with pornography, was his choice. And then there were other things that were defamatory and such that he would keep off of the iPod too. I said he wasn't into market research. And then another thing was that he was not particularly philanthropic. There's one story that I wanted to relay to you, and it was about the one instance of philanthropy that he did engage in that was discussed in the book. And it was only at the behest of Bono, the lead singer of U2. Bono wanted to get Jobs involved in a project to help people in Africa who had AIDS, or maybe help to prevent people in Africa from getting AIDS. Bono's been heavily involved in that. So, okay, that's actually the wrong one. Let me get to the right page here. Okay, yeah. So it says Bono got Steve Jobs to do another deal with him. You know, I don't know if you are familiar with this, but they made an actual iPod with nothing but U2 songs on it. Bosch actually purchased that one. You got this, right?
It wasn't, you got the actual thing with U2 songs, but you could put any old song that you want.
Oh, yeah, you could put other stuff on it. It wasn't like U2 tried to censor, right?
It was beautiful. Yeah. Red and black. It was red and black with the red circle that you, I guess, maneuver around. It was great.
Yeah. Now, Bono, it says, got Jobs to do another deal with him in 2006, this one for Project Red campaign that raised money and awareness for fighting for AIDS in Africa. It says, Jobs was never much interested in philanthropy, but he agreed to do a special red iPod as part of Bono's campaign. But it was not a wholehearted commitment. He balked, for example, at using the campaign's signature treatment of putting the name of the company in parentheses with the word red in superscript after it. So it would look like apple to the red, you know, like if you said X squared, it would look like that, but the red would be where the 2 is for the X squared, and apple would be in parentheses, and he would not let that happen. So for the iPod, it had to be product, the word product in parentheses with red, not apple red. And the whole point was, yes, he would, especially for a friend, engage in some sort of philanthropic project, but it was very rare. I mean, like I said, this is the only one in the whole book that I know about. His wife actually was involved in a philanthropic project. It had to do with helping kids after school with, I guess, getting up to speed so that they can get into college, something like that. And he never visited the project at all. So it just really was not a priority for him in the way that he used his time. But here, when he did it, he would not do it in a sacrificial way. He did not want Apple's name, the company's name, to be seen that way, and so it wasn't. That's all there was to it. So he wasn't philanthropic, and sometimes he was downright selfish. So let me see if I can find that reference. Now, for some reason, my iPad is cooperating with me a little bit better, but I still have to deal with the sheer volume of markings that I've got here. Okay, so here we are, 752. This is the page. Now, the question was whether they were going to do a music client for Android. You know, whether they wanted to go ahead and allow you to play iTunes music on your Android. And Jobs said, quote, we put iTunes on Windows in order to sell more iPods. See, because if you put the iTunes software onto a Windows computer, then you sell all these. But he says, I don't see an advantage of putting our music app on Android except to make Android users happy. And I don't want to make Android users happy, end quote. So if the whole purpose is just to make Android users happy and they're not going to get any product sales out of it, no, he's not going to do it. So he definitely chose the selfish road over the unselfish road. So those are a number of observations about Jobs and his, in some areas of his life, excellent methodology in terms of thinking. Now, of course, I think some people could have a reasonable disagreement about the strategy choice in terms of a fully integrated product line where you want to have control over the entire customer experience from beginning to end. Was he, you know, just a little bit too crazy about that versus the open system of Bill Gates? That was a debate that the two of them had over their life. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on that, if you think that maybe the open system has something more to say about it. The number is 760-888-5817. You probably also see that number on your screen, but it's 760-888-5817. I know that Jobs and Gates had that debate through the course of their life, and apparently the last word that Gates said was, I mean, both of them agreed that the other system could work, and that's how they were being gracious towards each other during their last meeting. But the book reports that Jobs said, well, sure, the open way works, but the products aren't very good.
And well, he said it less
and he probably said it less graciously than that. And what Gates said about Jobs is he says, yeah, well, I see that the closed system can work, but I think it could work only under someone like Steve Jobs. And understandably, Jobs seemed to be of two different moods with respect to comments like that. On the one hand, he took a medical leave at one point, and Cook, I think it's Tim Cook, who is now the CEO, he had given some statement to the board about how Apple can incorporate the overall philosophy of running Apple computers without Jobs being there. And he gave a statement to that effect to the board. And apparently when Jobs heard about that, he was upset. He felt, I mean, naturally you would feel, gosh, they can go on without me. This is kind of sad. But at the end, he did say, well, that's garbage. Anybody else can apply what, you know, the system that I'm using and do the same sort of thing. And in fact, there was one reference in the book to something called Apple University that they started within Apple in order to do case studies on the various big innovations that they had done in their history to say, okay, what did we do here that worked? What was it that made this product become such a great product and placed at the right time and all the different things? So they have done things to teach the methodology to other people within the organization and things like that. So this overall, I think his overall methodology in so many areas was pretty good. He was mixed, like I said, in politics. He was strong on some issues with regard to intellectual property, theft. He was principled in defending himself with respect to those things about censorship. You know, they said, gosh, you know, what would your hero Bob Dylan think of you? And he said, I think it'd be fine. He'd think, you know, free from all this garbage. That's great. But then there were areas in which he was definitely irrational. And the one that got me the most upset is that he was really irrational about his food. Really irrational about his food. And apparently the cause of it was that early on, you know, he's in his late teens or something, he discovered that it is possible to get some sort of euphoric high from fasting. So you fast and then at some point you get a pile of energy and, I mean, who knows, maybe you have this feeling of disconnect from reality because he also experimented in drugs, including LSD. So it could be that fasting at a certain point makes you delirious or something, and that was interesting, but it also, I guess, maybe gave him some energy. So he got into these weird things. There was fasting. There was times where he would eat only one food, like carrots or apples, for a period of time. He was, for the most part, a vegan. He would sometimes depart from that to eat fish, maybe sometimes eggs, a little bit of dairy products. But in general, he just did not get food very well. And he would go all the way through his life. Even when he was sick, he would stick to his vegan diet, go through fast, be very, very picky about his food. He was just as picky about his food as he was about design elements. So this, I don't think, served him very well health-wise, you know, in his life anyway. And certainly when he was trying to combat all the cancer treatments, you know, the chemo and everything that was making him weak, he needed to be eating more protein, and he wouldn't eat the best sources of protein, which would be your meat. He you know, finally got talked into eating eggs a little bit. So his view on food, I think, was just highly irrational. Oh, there's one thing from his early life, which is just, it's sort of funny, but it went on for so long, it got kind of crazy, was that he believed that with the vegan diet that he ate, that he wouldn't have body odor. And so he would literally go without showering for a week at a time. And it was, I think his first job was at Atari, and they really liked him. They thought he was productive and good. They wanted to keep him, but they put him on the night shift when he didn't have to work with anybody else because he smelled so bad. And apparently this went on so long. Yeah, he'd walk around barefoot all the time too, and he just put his dirty bare feet up on tables, you know, cross his legs up on somebody's table with his dirty bare feet too. But, you know, people told him time after time that, no, I'm sorry, your vegan diet isn't working. You actually do need to go take a shower. And he just wouldn't listen. And it finally took when they first hired a CEO to run Apple, you know, when the company got big enough to warrant that, one of the first meetings that the new CEO had with Steve Jobs was to tell him, sorry, you have to bathe more frequently. So this went on for a very long time into his early 20s. People and Isaacson have been talking about the so-called reality distortion field of Steve Jobs. And this distortion field, you could say, you know, exhibited itself with respect to food. But in general, they had this idea that he was somewhat detached from reality. And you see so many instances in the book where there are things that people think are impossible. And he says, no, you can do it. And he pushes people. And in fact, they do end up getting it done. So people sort of had this love-hate relationship with his so-called reality distortion field. Sometimes they thought that he misrepresented or misremembered who had come up with the key idea, so people's feelings were hurt in terms of getting credit. Obviously, the reality distortion field with respect to whether he needed to shower, also with respect to his medical treatment. He put off medical treatment for a long time. Having gotten the diagnosis of cancer, so all of these things were there. Now, why did he have this? Why did he have this so-called reality distortion field, and what did it actually consist of? I mean, there's two different ways you could look at it. One was maybe he was really good at seeing when people were limited by their own self-perception and when they actually could accomplish more than they were saying they could. If he was actually really good at this, maybe he was able to read them and able to push them in the right way and get them to do great things. On the other hand, it could be that all the time he was pushing for the impossible. He was having what objectivists would call a primacy of consciousness experience, where you put the I wish, you know, I wish for this thing to be able to happen over the it is. But at the same time, I mean, you know, if he does that all the time, then I guess maybe sometimes he's going to get lucky because he's going to say, no, this is possible. I know it is. And he's, you know, he was said to be so charismatic that his enthusiasm was infectious. And so that he would get the crew all motivated and they would actually get done on time what he said and thought that they should. Which one is it? You know, I would actually myself think it was probably some of each. That I think he had some element of being able to tell when somebody was sort of either too humble, lacking self-esteem, lacking confidence, and so he was able to push them and get them to do things that they didn't think that they could do before, which of course is a good thing. But it does seem that he also had this a little bit of a disconnect from reality here and there. There were times, especially when he went off to his business at Next, when he ran his own company, that he would spend inordinate amounts of money on the products and nobody could ever hope to make a profit the way that he was doing it. But he had this tremendous passion and attention to detail of making this product, and he would tell himself, yeah, he thinks he can make it work, and that it didn't work. That isn't so much of a problem when it comes to if he's willing to sacrifice his own money, you know. He is sacrificing his own money in that particular situation. Maybe he doesn't know it. You know, he's got some sort of psychology that's pushed him down this path, and he hasn't sought treatment for it. So at that point, you know, he just doesn't recognize that he's sacrificing. But, you know, when it's money, it's not such a big thing. The biggest problem is when it has to do with issues regarding his health, and when it has to do with slighting other people or pushing other people to do things that literally weren't possible. There was one incident with regard to this that I wanted to tell you about. Let me see if I can find it really quick here, where this so-called reality distortion field was the instigator for him accomplishing something really great. Yeah, here it is. So everybody has the iPhone. We know that the glass that is on the iPhone is very tough stuff. There are people who have busted their iPhones, but for instance, I actually watched Bosch drop the iPhone today. You dropped it today, right? It didn't bust. Pretty good. We're pretty impressed with it, right? So Corning apparently is responsible for this glass, and it was called Gorilla Glass. So Jobs went, met with the head of Corning, got a presentation on this Gorilla Glass, but there was no plant yet, you know, that at that time in existence that actually made the glass. It had been a project that they had developed and then shelved. And Jobs wanted as much Gorilla Glass as they could turn out after, you know, seeing how wonderful this product was. He wanted as much as they could turn out within 6 months. And Weeks, this guy Weeks, who was the head of Corning, he says, "We don't have the capacity. None of our plants make the glass now." And then here's Jobs' response. It's very interesting. "Don't be afraid," Jobs replied. That's the first thing he says to him. "Don't be afraid." And it says, "This stunned Weeks, who was good-humored and confident, but not used to Jobs' reality distortion field. He tried to explain that a false sense of confidence would not overcome engineering challenges, but that was a premise that Jobs had repeatedly shown he didn't accept. He stared at Weeks unblinking. "Yes, you can do it," he said. "Get your mind around it. You can do it," end quote. As Weeks retold this story, he shook his head in astonishment. Quote, "We did it in under 6 months," end quote, he said. "We produced a glass that had never been made," end quote. Corning's facility in Harrisburg, Kentucky, which had been making LCD displays, was converted almost overnight to making Gorilla Glass full time. Quote, "We put our best scientists and engineers on it, and we just made it work," end quote. He says in his area office, Weeks had just one framed memento on display. It was a message Jobs sent the day that the iPhone came out. Quote, "We couldn't have done it without you," end quote.
Wow.
So I thought that was such a powerful story. I mean, to me, that was just the best example of this. I mean, there were repeated examples where he was exhorting a crew that was working on one of the projects, the iMac or any of the others. This really does remind you of Atlas, because,
yeah,
you know, you've got Dagny coming up to the different vendors and saying, you know, "Can you get this done?" And then they do, you know, if they actually put their people on it, or, you know, reared in increasing the steel protection, you know, production if he has to. Anyway, it was truly amazing. It very much wowed me. And it, you know, it makes you think, was this reality distortion field something that he was actually good at getting the best out of people? Or was it that he was always pushing for the slightly impossible and he got lucky a lot of the time because he happened to, you know, to hit on people that they really could do more? And I think it's always true. We can do more than we think we can. So
he knew that.
I think he knew that, yeah. Now, I mean, he drove himself, of course, mercilessly. At the same time, he didn't waste any time doing things he didn't want to do. So he was a very interesting character. As I said, the one thing that he read over and over again was this autobiography of a yogi, which was more of a mystical Zen-oriented thing. He did use meditation. It talks about him in the book using meditation early on. He doesn't talk about it as much later, but I assume that he stuck with that throughout his life if he reread this book every year.
Did he describe yoga at all? Anything that's worthwhile, worth noting?
Not so much. Now, I did want to talk a little bit about this issue of LSD. I had a page marking for that about when he tried LSD and what it was that he thought he got out of it. Let me see if I can find that. In essence, it was that you could see that there was some other side of a coin. And he said, you don't remember that there's another side of the coin, but you don't remember the experience of it, but you remember that it's there. I kind of wonder whether having done LSD, where you're basically using drugs to put yourself under an illusion of some kind, gave him a bit of this reality distortion field, that it might have been responsible for it. What it wouldn't have been responsible for is the things that other people have talked about, which is he considered himself special and sort of outside the rules with respect to a lot of things. He could be very rude to people, not very concerned with other people's feelings. Even his wife complained about that in the book. It was a brief component in the book. It wasn't a constant refrain or anything, but it was also worth noting. Now, let me get a few other things that I had in here that I wanted to point out.
Some comments.
Yeah. Now, I do actually have a call, so I think I want to take that for a second before I've got some miscellaneous comments that we'll get to in a second. So let's try this. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Amy. This is Deborah.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
One of your regular callers from before.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was just calling to comment on the blog, the reality distortion field thing and where it might come from. Because it sounds like, I work in the engineering field as well, and it's true that there are a lot of naysayers. I don't know why, but people just get it in their heads really easily that something's not possible to do or that a problem's too hard to solve. And you really have to, kind of beat them over the head and tell them that, yes, it can be done. And now that doesn't have anything to do with reality distortion, but maybe if he already had this idea that he got in his head, probably from his mystical ideas that he encountered in India and seemed to be fond of, if he got this idea in his head that he could somehow have this power to distort reality, and then he observed all these other people just sort of impotent to do anything about it, but then he'd come along and say, no, we can do it, and we push him into it, and then, in fact, it could be done.
Right.
Maybe that's where it came from, because of his observations of the world, if he chose to construe it, to view it through this lens of him being able to manipulate things with his mind, maybe he could interpret his observations in the engineering world that way.
So, yeah, he did have a sense of what sorts of things could be accomplished because he built up a track record.
He brought these things into reality.
Yeah, he brought so many different things into reality and had the experience. He maybe in his mind did know, that this particular thing probably could be accomplished, and it's just the person's negative attitude that is preventing it from happening. So he just figures if he can change that person's attitude. And time and again in this book, you just see the amazing feats that were accomplished this way. They were always kind of, pushing the envelope as, for instance, what engineering, what features could be accomplished within a certain design, a beautiful design that they had come up with, right? And sometimes they had little missteps. So the example of the aluminum antenna, or was it a steel antenna that was around the outside of the iPhone 4, it had a problem. So, there's occasionally a limitation of the engineering. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's actually really frustrating because there's people just so readily give up on things preemptively before they've even tried them. And maybe if I had a more mystical worldview, I would think that I had special powers or something, but of course that's not the case. But maybe if somebody already saw the world that way, it would kind of reinforce it.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of, on the one hand, he completely criticizes Fox News as being destructive and as having messed everything up and, tells Murdoch, he basically tells Murdoch he doesn't want it to be his legacy. I'm not giving you the exact wording, but the thing I love about this book, I can remember so much about this book. I guess I have so much value orientation around this book. It's crazy the details I can remember. But, with Murdoch, he tells him this about Fox News. And then at the same time, he seems to be making some of the same criticisms that a Tea Party member might make. So he seems kind of torn, politically as well.
He's being assaulted. by the government as a businessman.
Bosch says he saw himself being assaulted.
Assaulted by the government.
Yeah.
And he was defending himself in words to the president directly, which is great. He called him out.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. Yeah,
I
love that message was delivered to Obama, because here you have, I mean, Jobs considered himself, I think, mostly a liberal. His wife was very liberal. Apparently, he was concerned that his wife, I mean, he wasn't really concerned that his wife was going to do anything, but he joked, you know, we have to hide all the knives in the house because I've got Rupert Murdoch coming over and, you know, she's going to kill me that I'm having him over here.
Well, just by the fact that he had him over was enough for far left.
Just having him, he also had said that he really admired some of the advertising that was done in Reagan's campaign, and he had actually volunteered to help Obama with this 2012 election campaign. I'm glad that he's not able to do that.
But they didn't really take that on.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, none of the people of Obama's people were deferential enough to Steve Jobs for his taste, so none of it ever really came to fruition there. But
I'm very grateful for that, because Steve Jobs would have done a really good job advertising for Obama.
he would have. And with the mess that is the Republican field now, you know, he may have succeeded pretty well. But, you know, he's conflicted. Overall, based on what I've told you, positive about Jobs or negative?
Generally positive, but it's a definite mixed case. I mean, there's elements there that are definitely bad and just tragically so, too, especially with this irrational side affecting his choice about waiting to get treatment for his cancer.
That's and the worst that's right just, there.
Oh, my God. When they had a thing on 60 Minutes about it last week, and I saw that, I could not believe it. I mean, my jaw just hit the floor when I heard that. Like, he'd probably be alive now if it hadn't been for his irrational attitude.
He was trying to experiment with his health.
Yeah, he was definitely experimenting with his health with respect to these so-called alternative treatments, diets, and acupuncture and other things. And I mean, first of all, I wonder how his consumption of food may have contributed to him getting ill at an early age. He thought that working one particular year where he was working full-time at both Pixar and Apple, he was running both companies, going back and forth, that may have made him ill. So his so-called reality distortion field, primacy of consciousness, may have made him think that he can handle the stress of doing both of those. He seemed to have been enjoying himself, though, so who knows whether that's true. But he made three different tragic decisions about his treatment once he learned about his cancer, and one was the delaying of the surgery, the initial surgery to take the tumor out of the pancreas. He delayed that for 9 months. And then even after that, he was told he was probably going to need a liver transplant at some point, and he put that decision off for a while, such that it was really touch and go whether he was going to make it the time that he got on the list for the liver transplant.
And what was his reason? Because he didn't want to be opened up.
Oh, yeah. His reason for putting off the initial surgery was that he didn't want his body opened up.
So he wanted
to die. So, I mean, that, you know, and that could have been part of his beliefs from the autobiography of a yogi. It doesn't say that anywhere in here. All we know is that he said he didn't want to be opened up. And his wife tried to talk him out of it, but she didn't have any luck there. And then even when he had the liver transplant, apparently he was going to go under a certain procedure where they recommended that he have his stomach pumped in order to make the procedure more safe. And he ended up not having his stomach pumped. And because of that, he aspirated some of the contents of his stomach and he got pneumonia.
So,
they're very, very basic decisions that you think, okay, he's a very smart person, in so many ways very rational, and then at the same time he made a few really tragic decisions.
He wanted to control his own sickness, I guess. I mean, in a sense where he didn't defer to the experts, to the doctors.
Yeah, it's
figured, well, I know my body and I'll probably do this. And
yeah. And I mean, and you'd think he'd have enough evidence by that point in time to he'd have enough evidence by that point in time in order to know that he couldn't bend reality when it came to his body. So, for example, the fact that he did get body odor, even though he ate years and years as a vegan and all those other things. So, Deborah, did you have anything more before we went on to more?
Just in general, I think it's a very strong case of mixed premises, and I love all the stuff about his attitude towards business, and it was fascinating, all this talk about the integration, which, I mean, that's just amazing.
Right.
But,
yeah. I mean, the way that I would put it overall is that he adopted an integrated approach in business.
Right.
If only he had adopted an integrated approach with respect to his personal philosophy of life. Because if he had, then I think he would have adopted all of these better premises that helped him in business. He would have been able to better identify, you know, what was this actual reality distortion field and say, okay, maybe it is just pushing people to go beyond their self-perceived limitations that are inaccurate, right? I think, you know, he would have been just that much better, but, you know, he was him, you know, he had a certain upbringing and he had some very good things that were instilled in him from an early age, all of the craftsmanship and the tremendous attention to detail and the perfectionism. And then on the other hand, he had these other things too. Some of them could have been psychological. The only therapy that I read in the book that he had gone through was some sort of primal scream therapy or something that he tried, and he dismissed it as some sort of cookie cutter approach that wouldn't apply, you know. But it is sad.
What led him there?
Thanks, Deborah, for being my first caller on Blog Talk Radio breaking it up a bit. I'm going to go ahead now and I'm going to tell you guys a few more of the cool things about Steve Jobs in here that I noted in the book.
Can we talk about Jobs for most of the show?
We can talk about Jobs for most of the show.
I'm up for that.
I mean, there's plenty to talk about here. Let me give you a little bit more. We've got, and actually I'm wondering if Bosch will take a look at the chat room here, because I'm wondering how far behind I'm getting on these.
Go down.
Yeah, we'll try to scroll down. Actually, this is the bottom of the chat room. So maybe Bosch can see what's going on in the chat room while I am going through some more of these details. One thing that I wanted to say also apropos of Jobs being considered as a Howard Roark, with respect to that, he was a fan of architecture along the lines of Frank Lloyd Wright. Frank Lloyd Wright, as we know, if you're a fan of Rand, was not necessarily the inspiration for Howard Roark, but certainly someone who is considered to be compatible with the sort of architect that Rand portrayed in Howard Roark. And Rand herself was a big fan of Frank Lloyd Wright, and she actually asked Wright to develop a house for her, to put together a plan for a house for her, which he did. So there was another architect by the name of Eichler, Joseph Eichler. Eichler was a disciple of Frank Lloyd Wright, and it turned out that Steve Jobs was brought up in a house that was built by Joseph Eichler. Now, Eichler specialized in bringing that sort of kind of sparse, wonderfully clean and simple architecture to middle-class families so that they could actually afford this sort of architecture. It says in the bio here on page 43 in my iPad version, it says, Eichler built inexpensive houses that featured floor-to-ceiling glass walls, open floor plans, exposed post and beam construction, concrete slab floors, and lots of sliding glass doors. So this is the sort of house that Jobs was brought up in, and it's thought that being brought up in this house gave him a certain design sense. He sort of internalized a certain design sense for himself. Now, another detail here from page 81. Oh, so here's a passage that has to do with his thoughts, his early thoughts on what he calls intuitive understanding versus abstract thinking. So here's a quote from Jobs. It says, Jobs was deeply influenced by the emphasis that Buddhism places on intuition. And here's the quote from Jobs. I began to realize that an intuitive understanding and consciousness was more significant than abstract thinking and intellectual logical analysis. End quote. So what does he mean by intuition? Is intuition sort of the result of your subconscious working on a problem and then integrating all of these things and coming up with something wonderful? He obviously took the Buddhist interpretation of what his mind was doing. But as I said, a number of times he's praised in the book for having a sense of both the abstract and the concrete. So it wasn't like he was typically lost in the clouds, although he was sometimes definitely lost in the clouds. Now, let me get back to my next one. It says that Jobs refused to accept automatically received truths, and he wanted to examine everything himself.
First-rate thinker.
Yeah, definitely a first-rate, first-handed thinker, where he was definitely thinking for himself. Now, also on page 100 here. Oh, now this is, he went to India, spent 7 months in Indian villages, and then he says he came back. He says, you see the craziness. He says, I saw the craziness of the Western world as well as its capacity for rational thought. If you just sit and observe, you will see how restless your mind is. If you try to calm it, it makes it worse, but over time it does calm. And he's talking here about what he got out of meditation, that he actually got some value out of meditation, and he thinks that somehow the Indians have a better way to calm their mind down, but then in the Western world you get the capacity for rational thought. So he seemed to have a dichotomy between the two. And he says, Zen has been a deep influence on my life ever since the trip. He says, at one point I was thinking about going to Japan and trying to get into an Ihaji monastery. He says, but my spiritual advisor urged me to stay here. He said, there is nothing over there that isn't here, and he was correct. I learned the truth of the Zen saying that if you are willing to travel around the world to meet a teacher, one will appear next door, end quote. So I'm so glad that he has spiritual advisor told him, you don't have to go run off, because then he just died, you know, he dove full on into business and basically, I think, forgot
back.
A lot of that.
He chose back to come to America. He chose.
He chose to come back here. As I said, he did try this primal scream therapy, which he ended up dismissing and said that it really didn't do that much. And let's see what else. I've got a few more. 205. Oh, this is simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Mm. That came from his background in design. And 208.
As Alex Toth said, to add to truth subtracts from it. I think he was quoting a musician, but simple. I mean,
yeah, and they would apparently just spend days and days and days trying to simplify and simplify and simplify, both in the software and in the hardware. Right. As few buttons, and at one point, someone had said that he took an iPad to somewhere in South America. There was an illiterate 6-year-old kid, and he let the kid pick up the iPad, and within a minute or two the kid was using it and figuring out what to do. He was completely illiterate, and that just is a testament to how simple Jobs wanted to make these things. And towards the end of the book there were a couple of really good statements from Jobs to this effect. He said
nothing got in the way.
Well, and this is what he said. He thought it was his job to make it that way, because he said everybody else wants to specialize in what they're good at it, and he says you may as well let me get everything taken care of with respect to the integration of all your devices, you know.
So, nothing to get in the way of what you want, whether it's reading a book, whether it's check out the internet.
Yeah, and everything could be done very, very simply. He wanted to make it simple for people to get their information, to create things, to do what was important to them, and let him take care of the technological means of doing it. I don't know if you've ever tried to integrate devices on Windows. It can be a nightmare. And half the time, you know, you just bring a device in the realm of the Wi-Fi of your computer, and suddenly it starts saying, oh, I recognize this, and they start working together. It's awesome. Here's another quote from Jobs about great art. Right. He says, great art stretches the taste. It doesn't follow the tastes. Hmm. And this is part of his idea that if he is a great innovator and a great artist with respect to creating these new devices, he is going to go beyond what people think they want. He is going to stretch their taste even further.
And he just sees himself as an artist, in a sense. I mean,
and this is one thing that they always – portrayed themselves as. They portrayed themselves as the intersection of the liberal arts and the humanities.
Right.
And I don't know if he saw himself as, I mean, he saw an intersection, which I think is good. I don't think he saw it as a dichotomy of any kind. But at the same time, he seemed to associate the liberal arts with certain elements of irrationality in his personal life, like I said. So when I hear that, I take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. And
did you want to mark off the hour?
Yeah. Gosh, have we gone a whole hour on Steve Jobs here?
Can we go?
We can.
I would like to.
Okay, so all for the last hour, I've been telling you my perspective on the Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson. As I said, I recommended the biography highly. I thought it was well written. I liked the way that it was structured. There were a couple exceptions, but no problem. One thing that I actually didn't say about it was, yes, Isaacson does let you know his opinion sometimes, but I don't think his opinion was too much of a stretch given all the information that he gives you there. So it's not like he was imposing
No.
some sort of crazy stretch opinion. Now, Bosch has had the experience. He's been listening to the audio version.
Yeah, the guy's pretty annoying.
Yeah. Now, I beat you, right?
Yeah, you beat me big time.
I beat you? Yeah, I read it on the iPad, and Bosch has been listening to it, listening to it through iTunes.
You can tell the guy's attitude, certain things. I don't care for his style, but I'm getting over it because it's so.
And it's the reader, though.
Yeah.
It's the reader's style. It's not Isaacson's writing that's necessarily a bother. So, yes, he does give you his opinion sometimes, and his opinion of Jobs is somewhat mixed, but it's overall positive, which is how mine is as well. I think one of the reasons that I rail so much at, some of the statements, of Jobs that hint at the irrationality that he had is because I feel like, gosh, if you could only beat some sense into this guy and he would have gotten these medical treatments or he would have fed himself better, maybe we'd still be able to be benefiting and he'd still be able to have the life that he enjoyed because he clearly loved what he did.
And loved life.
On August 24th, which was that meeting of the board of directors where he announced that he'd have to step down as CEO, at that meeting, he was playing with the Siri, the voice recognition that's in the new iPhone, and he was playing with it in a very fun way and trying to trip it up and everything. And he just showed all the way up to the very end his passion for the products, his hope that he had put together not just a bunch of great products, but he had also established a company that would continue on long after him. But when you just think he was only 56 years old, and if you believe that had some of these decisions gone differently, that it would have made a huge difference, it definitely makes you sad. I teared up several times reading this book, so that might make me a wimp. I don't know. I had actually talked to someone, a colleague of mine, who I don't really know him that well, and he doesn't know me well, so he wouldn't know that I'd be in this category. But he was talking about, oh, those people who take the death of Steve Jobs so personally. And I immediately said, well, hey, I'm one of those people. And I do. Now, why is it? I guess there's so many things that we admire about him. And like I said, I was happy to see in this biography that those things came through. The good things that we admire him for, they are very much there, and they accomplished even more than I had known before.
The idea about him integrating it all, that's just really, as opposed to the fragmented way that he was calling about the other companies
and their
products. I mean, that's great. It's great to hear it put that way.
Yeah. Now, Jobs' attitude towards money was interesting. Yeah, on the one hand,
complex, yeah.
Yeah, he said he himself wasn't so concerned about money, but he sure did at certain points in time demand that he would get fair compensation. Some of the issues with respect to his compensation were messed up entirely because of the government regulation that's required. So there's certain sort of accounting practices that are required by government, such that if a company gives options in a certain way, then they have to value them a certain way. So at one point, the options that he was given, their worth was set by some bizarre imposed accounting practice at $872 million. But in reality, they weren't worth anything because the company's stock had dropped. And so, you know, basically they did something weird with the accounting to backdate something so that he could get compensated fairly, but at the same time he wouldn't look like he was getting overcompensated. I mean, between the SEC and the way that the culture looks upon the compensation of CEOs, he was just messed up with respect to that. But he himself said time and again that it was not for him about the money particularly. He did want to be recognized. And, of course, money does symbolize the recognition of the value that you provide for people. Mm-hmm. And that was important to him. But he did not live an ostentatious lifestyle. There were a few expensive things that he did pursue. For instance, he asked for a plane at a certain point. And why? Because it made the life that he lived so much easier. I mean, he flew around both for work and for traveling with his family a lot. But he lived in a house that was very simple for the type of money that he had. And he didn't have, you know, any particular big old imposing gates and security and all those sorts of things. So,
one second. Do you want to comment on this? First, I got defensive there about it. His health. Of course it is.
It is health. Yeah, it is his health to experiment with, definitely. Yeah.
But at the expense of his life.
Oh, yeah, no, all of this stuff, it's right. Chris is on the chat here, and he's saying it's his health to experiment with. The stuff about not showering, his food preferences, all that completely pales in comparison.
And that's what we're getting across here.
Oh,
clearly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is my perspective overall, is that this was a great man, and that I just am sad about those things about him that maybe could have made his life longer and better if he had done them differently. But, you know, he didn't have, I guess, the benefit of a philosophy that would help him judge these things. I don't know what more to say. But no, I am not criticizing him. And in so many of the things where other people would criticize him, I think he's right. You know, some people criticize him for his closed philosophy. Some people criticize him for the so-called censorship. I am an avid defender.
But that's not what messaging is, what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yes, we know that.
Yeah.
We know it was his health. We know it was his life, his choices, yes, but at the expense of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was his life to do with as he pleased.
Of course,
as well.
Presumably, you know, he wanted to live. I mean,
well, one thing they said in the book, though, when the Isaacson said, is that he repeatedly told people early on that he thought he was going to die young, and that he felt he had to, you know, do a lot. Now the question is, you know, who knows how the subconscious works, and if you know, elements of psychology. I mean, I guess I could psychologize forever. Did that have any role in the decisions that he made? People could speculate about that, and somebody in psychology could do a better job of it than I could. I am sad about those things. Overall, this is a great man, and I will continue to defend Steve Jobs everywhere. Obviously, yeah, he's a mixed case. But the things that he did are so amazing. And like I said, I didn't even know about some of the examples, like that Gorilla Glass example. You know, making this great product, the iPhone, and the things that had to go into it. There are a number of stories like that in the book where he just had to go and then, like, you know, acquire a certain element of a company in order to get the thing done that he wanted to get done. And nobody thought he could do it, and nobody thought he could make the deal, and he did. And just amazing. Yeah, let me see what else we've got here. And I've got one more that I wanted to get to in terms of notes on the page numbers here. Okay. I made way too many notes. This is really an excellent book. I really suggest it. Like I said, I learned a lot about the product development, which is not necessarily my emphasis here in the show, because here I'm more interested about his ideas and what effect they had on his life and how they contributed to the value that he provided for all of us. One thing that he said, that when he started really thinking about his mortality often because he was so sick, he said that it was a real terrible thing. He says, if you live with a disease like this and all the pain, it constantly reminds you of your own mortality. And that can do strange things to your brain if you're not careful, he said. He says, you don't make plans more than a year out, and that's bad. You need to force yourself to plan as if you will live for many years, end quote. So this is an example of his preference for long-range thinking, right? He's the kind of person who was planning his projects over the course of a lifetime. Obviously, you're going to be more specific about the projects that you're going to do in the, you know, next several years and put more detail thought into that. But he clearly thought long-range, which was the sign of anybody who was very rational. I think that was about what I had in terms of observations on this. I've got a piece that I'm thinking of writing that looks at Steve Jobs from a particular perspective and actually compares him to elements of Aristotelian philosophy, and I'll keep you in the loop about that. You know, but in general, like I said, overall, he had so many good elements in his thinking, his integrated thinking versus fragmented, his willingness to decide for himself with his team what they thought was a great product and then let the customers come to them with respect to their tastes. He wasn't going to go out and do market research and try to figure that out.
Push himself and others.
Yeah. His ability to think about both the big picture and the smallest of details and to shuffle from one to the other so well was excellent. He could do the same thing apparently in business negotiations. He'd go on a walk with one of these guys and they'd start talking about, you know, the big picture relation of how those two companies could work together. And then by the end of the walk, they're talking about the little details of the negotiations and hammering out the deal. Very strong with IP. I really liked his attitude about IP, and I really liked his attitude with regard to the censorship question. So excellent. I was not at all disappointed by what I learned in this book. I would say that I learned some good things that I hadn't known before. I learned obviously some bad things that I hadn't known before, and any of those balanced out so that I still had basically the same overall positive feeling towards Jobs that I had before. A little bit more emotional about it because the book does immerse you in all of the detail and really makes you value him and his life that much more.
And also, so, you know, he gets known because he was so private that these revelations, like, whoa, you had no idea about it.
You know, I sort of wonder because, you know, all these years when I really wasn't so aware of him being sick and stuff, and I was just enjoying the products that he made. He wasn't as much personally on my radar. I imagine that a lot of this I could have known had I really pored over everything that was out there.
So, for example,
I think Fortune magazine at one point released some details about his health he had said that they didn't have permission to talk about. He was deeply hurt by that. So there were things
But this is him, his willingness to talk about himself to this biographer.
Yeah.
Let him know everything that, you know, without any fear, really.
Yeah.
And his wife said that she wanted that also. She goes, look, tell it all.
Yeah. And I think he made exactly the right choice to have story told basically his way out there.
Absolutely. He set the terms out there. There's a biography out there that he was actually authorized, you know, that's authorized by him. Yeah. And now everyone else has to follow suit.
One thing you said you read today was a eulogy by his sister, Mona Simpson.
Yeah, by sister. It was in New York Times.
Now, Mona Simpson is
a novelist.
Yeah, and she was his sister, but his actual blood sister.
Right,
he didn't grow up with her.
From his biological parents, his Syrian Muslim father, which Jobs, you want to mention? You want to mention about it or not?
Well, a lot of people already know this story if they've been watching the coverage in the media. Basically, Jobs never met his father. She met his father. And in meeting their father, she learned from the father that the father had run a restaurant that Steve Jobs had gone to. And the father had actually remembered that Steve Jobs had been there.
And he
said, you know, he told his daughter, Mona, he says, I wish you could have seen me when I was running this bigger restaurant. It was great. And everybody came, even Steve Jobs. And
pretty incredible.
They had met, they'd shook hands. And his father had called Steve Jobs a great tipper, that he was nice.
Yeah, but they didn't
they didn't meet his father and son ever. So what struck you about this? I mean, the eulogy overall, very positive?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's a sister's eulogy for Steve Jobs, New York Times. And the thing that jumped out at me, which goes, Steve told me it was a good thing. I'm skipping here. But anyway, he said he was making something that was going to be insanely beautiful. This is, I think, mid-80s, I guess it was.
Yeah, insanely great is another phrase that you hear him use a lot. Yeah.
Steve worked at what he loved. He worked really hard. every day. That's incredibly simple, but true. Novelty was not Steve's highest value. Beauty was. You know, these are just the things that have jumped out at me that I, you know, Steve was like a girl in the amount of time he spent talking about love. Not, you know, he says, love was his supreme virtue, his god of gods. He tracked and worried about the romantic lives of the people working with him. That's pretty funny.
Now, what's interesting is that didn't come up in the biography.
Okay.
That was not.
So this is some real intimate details. He treasured happiness. He treasured happiness. And then, you know, she said about him, he tried. He always tried, and always with love at the core of that effort. He was an intensely emotional man.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting also.
Mm-hmm.
You want to read this here? Or,
yeah.
Even about this, you know, even ill, you know, when he was sick, his taste, his discrimination, and his judgment held. He went through 67 nurses before finding kindred spirits, and then he completely trusted the three who stayed with him to the end. And she names three of the nurses that ended up.
You know, there was another story that when he was getting his liver transplant in Tennessee, he was they had to put some mask on him, either for oxygen or maybe
right.
And he says, the design of this mask is terrible. Why don't you give me five options and
right.
I'll figure out which one, you know. I guess he thought he was in an Apple meeting for a minute and, you know, this is a terrible design. Let's
so
get five
funny.
Other ones.
He was also drawing certain things around him in the hospital. He wanted to redesign them.
Yeah, yeah. He wanted to redesign maybe IVs and
everything
all sorts.
Around
yeah,
him.
Everything around him.
Yeah. So that's, you know, it's that's it really. And then they have his last words in the thing, which
I didn't want to know that.
Yeah, which I think everyone should read. You know,
I didn't want to read his last words. You don't have things like his last words in the bio. So
she did.
I don't know. People have different ideas about that.
You know, she's also a writer. I guess, you know, I just want to have the last words of his story,
yeah.
of the Steve Jobs story.
I want to see if we have any thoughts on the chat room here that people haven't shared with me otherwise. I've got the one caller. Let me see. Open source systems. Microsoft has Gates, who seems to absolutely hate his money and doesn't seem at all interested in explicitly investing his company and making it grow. That is a comment there from Nolan. Now, Gates, you know, it's funny. Gates denied, but I think Jobs thought that Gates was actually more concerned about making money, but making money so he could give it away and have this whole philanthropic enterprise.
That sounds right.
But the reason that Jobs would criticize Gates more was because Gates wasn't as passionate about products.
Right, making the best possible.
And, of course, there's the famous line where he says that Gates had no taste. And I think he also said that Gates should have tried LSD and then...
That's pretty funny. And, you know, again, we looked at the Microsoft store, which is like a a ripoff of the Apple store, but not as much style. I mean, literally.
Oh, yeah, if you walk by the window, yeah. The Windows store looks like a...
Like a bad version.
Yeah.
Like a tasteless version of the Apple store.
I was
going to
say a tacky version of the Apple store. I feel bad. I don't want to insult
people.
No, but
it really says something about that's Gates and the Apple store is Jobs, you know.
Yeah.
It is them.
Nolan says, I think Jobs is a failed Hank Reardon. I don't know that he was a completely failed Hank Reardon. I
no.
think he had some, you know, some character flaws
that caught up with him.
Really caught up with him. You know, because again, this reality distortion field, yeah, I think especially if the tech world is, as Deborah described, where you've got a lot of naysayers in the world of engineering and technology and software development, someone like Jobs can push back at that and say, no, you really can do it. You can do it. And clearly he had the effect on Weeks, you know,
clearly.
Weeks, who was the head of Corning. That was an amazing effect that he had in terms of rallying the guy to make the Gorilla Glass.
He was very reality-based, no doubt about it.
Well,
I mean,
and clearly he was in a lot of what he did, but in the ways that he was irrational, it ended up undermining him so badly. And in some cases, the ways that he treated people would cost him relationships with them too. I'm not so sure that he cared as much about that though. Nolan says he was rational in most aspects of his work life, but his personal life was just riddled with terrible convictions. Yeah, definitely a tremendous value. And like I said, I've got a little bit more work and processing and formulating to do with respect to everything that I took in this book. Highly recommended. I think you'll enjoy it if you enjoy biographies. And if you like Steve Jobs, I do think you'll come away liking him just as much as you did before. So let's shift. We've got 40 minutes to talk about everything else in the world. And, you know, some people would say, okay, we should be talking this week about Europe and how they bailed out Greece and all of those things. First of all, I think some other people have talked about that topic better. One is Yaron Brook did a little PJTV segment on the bailout of Greece this last Friday. So you could go ahead and find that. I think the version I saw was up on YouTube, so it was easily accessible. Yeah, they got bailed out to the tune of 50% of the debt being written off. It was a haircut. I guess that's the term in the finance industry. They got a haircut, is what they say. Yaron analyzes it as just punting it down further down the football field. So more of the same, you know, more bailouts, more pushing the problem to years down in the future. And I thought definitely more important to talk about somebody who was a great innovator and a producer and to try to get at what was it that made him so good. That is a question that I'm interested in. These technology companies, are they better if they are fully integrated, or is it better in the long term to do the open source? If you're concerned about the quality and the artistry of the products, it seems clearly
the integrated approach wins out.
Look at
the success, though, of Apple.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful. Yeah. Well, and then is it, as Gates said, it's going to be tied to Steve Jobs. And now that we have no Steve Jobs, then we're going to see the demise. Jobs believes that he has taught and that Apple has internalized his overall approach to product development and the love for the products. His designer, Johnny Ive, in particular, was kind of offended when people were, you know, speculating that it couldn't go on without Jobs because he thought he had contributed so much to the design of the products, and he had.
Well, that's they're going to prove it to us.
Yeah.
That's
what we're going to have to see. So on to negative, yucky topics. One is Occupy Wall Street. And the thing that's worth mentioning with Occupy Wall Street, other than I think they've gotten snowed on now so that their occupation is being made all the more difficult.
Right.
There was a rap sheet that was released. It was posted by John Nolte on Big Journalism, and it was posted on October 28th, but it was also updated. So there are 100 different incidents of crimes from, you know, petty to more serious. I don't think there's been a murder, for instance, but there has been various accusations of rape and sex crimes and stealing and... there's a whole list here. So starting on October 1st in 2011, police arrest more than 700 protesters on the Brooklyn Bridge because they're blocking traffic. And then it goes all the way up until the 29th of October when it says Tennessee protesters were arrested for the second straight night for misconduct that they had. There was a man arrested in Austin, Texas on the 22nd after a knife incident at Occupy Austin. What else do we have? 23 arrested, remains of protests filled two dumpsters, so they left their trash there to the tune of two dumpsters worth. Occupiers do $40,000 worth of property damage in Calgary. Occupy Austin protesters blocked the cleaning crews. Police clashes with protesters.
Of course they would block the cleaning crews.
And then at 6 a.m. today in Zuccotti Park, there was an alleged sex assault. And the thing that, so I guess that would mean incident number 101. And one thing that they've done is they've taken it upon themselves, the Occupy people, of being vigilante enforcers instead of calling the police. So the vigilante occupiers were said to have used flashlights and yell at the guy to get him out of there, shining flashlights in his face and yelling at him to leave. Said a woman who called herself Leslie but refused to give her real name.
And the left-wing media is not reporting any of this.
Right? Yeah, and she said, this is the New York Post, of course, reporting this. She said that weeks earlier another woman was raped. She says, we don't tell anyone. We handle it internally. I said too much already. Interesting. So they clearly don't seem to be the same as the Tea Party protesters, which is the thing. The thing I was wondering, though, I mean, first of all, the Tea Party protesters would never think of themselves as going to occupy, as going to camp out for weeks on end, or I don't know how long they plan to do this, right? So they wouldn't do that. Is it the case that if the Tea Party protesters had decided to have a camp out, that it would be inevitable that there would be a small minority among them even that would engage in some sort of criminal activity? First of all, they don't see themselves as occupying, right?
They do that when they can. They go out there and protest when they can because they're working.
Yeah. Tea Party protests are so mild.
They are.
And they're brief, too. You know, people go there, they listen to the speakers, and then they leave.
And then when it comes to election day is when they really go out there and, you know, make their voice heard.
Now, the other thing I saw this week is that Michael Moore apparently went to visit Occupy
Fest Up.
Portland. Was it Portland?
Part of the 1%, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Because he was called out by this leftist on CNN and said, well, you're part of the 1%. He goes, no, I'm not. And then I guess he fessed up finally. Just whatever. I don't even know what to say about him.
I don't know. With him, I don't like to make jokes about people's weight and stuff, but the one thought that occurred to me was if he could just give part of his food away to people who were starving.
That's right.
It would be better for him
to redistribute his food.
And for them.
Yeah.
He could redistribute his food. It would be lovely. But
you know what? Can I just, about jobs, Nolan makes a clarification.
Sure.
About the Reardon thing.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, Nolan clarifies that he says Reardon was able to identify his flaws and confront and overcome them, whereas Steve Jobs was philosophically inconsistent to the end.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's true.
You know, towards the actual last stage of his illness, it said that they were pursuing an integrated approach to his medical care. They had actually used the terms fragmented and integrated with respect to describing the care. And they said that the care had been fragmented. But, I mean, you know, I think the fact that the care was fragmented, which it often is when you've got, you know, one specialist working on one thing and another specialist working on another.
He made it very difficult for himself.
He made it difficult for himself from because of the early irrational decisions that he made. But one of the things that he was doing was he was on the very cutting edge of trying to treat this cancer later. He had his DNA sequenced. So I think they sequenced his healthy DNA, and then they sequenced the cancer DNA so that they could get drugs that would differentiate and kill only the cancerous DNA cells. So I thought that was interesting and that was good. That was the sort of approach that you would expect a Steve Jobs to take, but he didn't take it, I think, early enough. He was, of course, at the very end, very jealous of his time. Isaacson doesn't talk about it too much in the biography, but he talked about it in some interviews that I saw. Maybe it was on the 60 Minutes piece, where he said that Jobs kind of was very picky about who he saw during the last several months of his life.
Right.
There were people who wanted to come and see him and he wouldn't see him. He thought it was a waste of his time.
Yeah.
And then there were other people.
And they were hurt over
He spent 3 hours with Bill Gates, for example, because he wanted
he
to
significant also.
Talk to him. He saw Bill Clinton towards the end as well. But yeah, we have definitely missed out this week, but I do think, I mean, it can't be the case that only one person is capable of, you know, doing that sort of job with a tech institution. The question is, are there enough of them existing and living at the same time that someone will be able to take over Apple? Have they identified the so-called A players well enough that they've got them all in Apple and they're ready to work with them?
I mean, I say they probably have, but we will tell. Time will tell. Yeah. Within a few years, we'll know.
You know, one other thing about the way that he ran Apple, he did talk about this issue of A players versus B players versus C players. And he definitely seemed to be describing what Rand would have said is the proper approach and the virtue of justice.
Right.
He said explicitly that he learned that A players want to work with only A players and that you had to be ruthless in weeding out the B players and the C players because the A players would feel demoralized if you condoned or tolerated the weaknesses of the B players and the C players on the team, that you had to get them out.
The A players can take it,
whatever
he dished out.
And another thing that he did is, unlike other companies, there weren't separate divisions. So this is another thing that they meant by integrated. They had everybody meet together frequently, a lot of face-to-face meetings in terms of getting the ideas. And they would meet frequently. They would all go on the same profit and loss statement. Everything was integrated about that company as well. So there was a lot of good about him. But as I said, some irrational decisions that cost us here. I've got another caller, so I'm going to go ahead and take it. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Pooja Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. I wanted to talk about the Occupy Wall Street, you know, and Tea Party, and you know, I just wanted to voice my complaint about not liking any comparison that is made between the two. And I'm actually offended by, I like being a Tea Partier myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen Occupy Wall Street being called as, you know, the bad brother, or you know, there's an image flying on Facebook where they have
the bad boy Tea Party or something.
Right, and actually there's an image out there on Facebook where you have two arrows which basically start from the same basic route and go in two different directions, and they say basically it's trying to say that it's all starting from, you know, basic frustration or complaints of the government, but they're trying to solve the problem in two different ways. And the reason I'm offended by that is because saying that just means that the Wall Street the Occupy Wall Street people have the legitimate frustrations like the Tea Partiers, and that's not true. You know,
right.
I mean,
There are some legitimate concrete things that they point to that would be some of the same concrete things that Tea Partiers would point to, bailouts and stuff.
Yeah,
but the reason for them pointing those things out is entirely different, right? The reason that the Tea Party doesn't want a business to be bailed out is because they think that the government doesn't have a role in bailing out businesses and picking winners and losers. They think the market should clear these losers all out, right? Whereas the Occupy Wall Street people, they think, oh, those evil Wall Street people, they have too much money already.
And they want to be bailed out themselves.
Yeah, they'd rather the money come to them, you know. So they want the stealing to go in a different direction.
Yeah, Tea Party and the Pea Party, because they go out there and publicly, you know, right?
Yeah. Right, and saying that, yeah, these people are frustrated too, just like the Tea Party is, you know, draws some sympathy towards them, which I think is wrong, and that's why.
I think about it also, you know, Tea Party has been maligned so badly that when they try to equate them, it's like, are you saying that the, you know, Occupy parties are racist? You know me or no?
It's so funny. If they make a comparison now, some of the liberal media should not be eager to make the comparison at all, because they had said the Tea Party were terrorists and all these other horrible things.
That.
And it's so funny. The Tea Party are terrorists when they weren't even guilty of any of these crimes.
And look at
this rap sheet that John Nolte put together. It's a huge list of crimes. So... It's just nutty. I mean, really, what you've got is
it's the freeloaders' revolution.
Occupy Wall Street is a freeloaders' revolution.
Yeah.
You've got in this country everybody knowing that there's something wrong, right? And it's very similar to Atlas in this way, where we all realize that there's something wrong.
It's terribly wrong, right?
And then what you think is wrong, what you identify as being wrong, and what you prescribe as the solution is going to be dependent on your basic philosophy. So those people who have really altruism throughout their makeup, which is your Occupy Wall Street people, they've internalized it so much, and they are the unproductive. They are the mooching side of it, right?
And they want more government.
They want more government. They think they're entitled to things. They've been told for decades that they are entitled to things because of the altruistic morality, and they're just demanding what they're entitled to. So they're there. The Tea Party, I think many in the Tea Party do have altruism internalized up to a point, but they are rebelling against it. There's a sense of life in the Tea Party that, again, I've said this repeatedly, and it's, you know, embodied also in cartoons now. The Tea Party says, "Don't tread on me," right? And I love that cartoon that I've seen repeatedly on Facebook, where the Tea Party is one guy holding up a sign saying, he says, "Don't tread on me." And then the Occupy guy is next to him, and he's got a sign or a T-shirt pointing with an arrow pointing to the Tea Party guy saying, "Tread on him."
And that's exactly what it is.
And that's the essential, because these are movements at the political level, right? Now, obviously, their political views are conditioned by their views about morality. But at the political level, we've got the Tea Party saying, leave us alone. And we have Occupy saying, go grab us some more stuff. We deserve it. Yeah. So it's completely different. And I understand, you know, with the comparison, I think because the Tea Party people are generally who they are, that even if for some reason, and they wouldn't do this, but suppose the Tea Party decided they needed to camp out for weeks on end, I think that they would have the police allow them to come through. They'd allow the cleaning crews to come through. They'd clean up after themselves. I mean, we've seen the sites of Tea Party demonstrations
like
versus Occupy. There's much less trash. You know, there's hardly any trash at a Tea Party demonstration left over afterwards. They clean up after themselves. It's just a world of difference, and it's the difference between the entitlement mentality versus we just want the government to get back to its proper role and leave us alone, please.
No, big difference.
So I share that with you, and I hope I didn't say anything that said that, I mean, implied that I was sympathetic with the comparison. Did I say something to that effect, Pooja?
No, I wasn't talking to you, Amy. I was just generally talking to how people, you know, when they mentioned Occupy Wall Street, and I'm like, I don't even like, you know, the name of the Tea Party being taken when you're talking about Occupy Wall Street, you know, because it kind of puts them in a light that I don't really like to see them.
Yeah, no,
They're parasites through and through, even in a sense. They're also ripping off the Tea Party in a sense where without the Tea Party, they probably wouldn't exist, the Occupiers.
Well, and then they've been ripping off each other.
Yeah, literally.
And then it was interesting because there was a story that one of the cooks for the Occupy,
right.
they were
protesting the Occupiers.
Well, but yeah, and one of the cooks for Occupy was resenting giving food away to people who weren't contributing to Occupy itself, and they're being caught in their contradictions all over the place as well. So anything more before we go on to another topic, Pooja?
No, thank you, Amy.
Okay, thanks very much for calling in. This is kind of fun to have my little call-in board and everything, and then we're trying to get a handle on this chat.
The sound also, I mean, I'm curious how it sounds as opposed to the old.
Michael has a great comment back on the Jobs issue. He says, unfortunately, Jobs didn't have a Francisco D'Anconia visiting him.
Right, true.
He could have.
Oh, yeah, he could have if he was open to it, but let's, you know.
You know, when I think of, and it's mentioned a few times in the book, the fact that he actually did get his email. Why did I never write that man an email? I never wrote that
because
man an email.
We thought it was inaccessible. I mean, he's, you know.
I would have written him an email if I had known something. I should have done it. I mean, I was just busy enjoying his products. The one thing that I did, which I think was a good matter of justice, I'm so glad I did it, I published this on my blog at don'tletitgo.com. Back in 2002 was when I got my first desktop Mac. I had gotten an iPod before that. So it was exactly as Steve Jobs imagined it, because their goal was to make iPods available and compatible with Windows machines as a way to luring people into the Mac. So I got my iPod. It was beautiful. It had worked much better than the clunky MP3 player I had purchased before that. And I was getting frustrated with my PC, even with Windows Vista, which I think had improved, or it was XP. Windows XP, I think, had improved the situation a little bit in terms of crashing. When I saw the so-called Sunflower Mac, I was just floored, and I had to have it. So I got it. I wrote this wonderful review, and I called the review Fashion, Function, and Fun All in One, and just exuded.
That was an integrated title. Fashion, fun.
Just fashion, function, and one fun. Yeah.
All in one.
Yeah, fashion, function, fun, all in one. And so I really sung the praises of the product. So at least I did that. But I wish I had written him and tried to instill some philosophy in him. Back in 2002, it might have been early enough, right?
Yeah. Just have a conversation.
Yeah. Now, Nolan says, I have a fear that OWS will go down as the Woodstock of political protests. Yeah. I've seen those comparisons being made already to Woodstock. And then that they try to paint.
They're all slobs, you know, in that sense.
Yeah. Okay, now on to the Middle East a little bit. Some bad news this week. Afghan insurgents killed 13 Americans in a car bomb. This was a Taliban insurgent driving a vehicle packed with explosives, slammed into a U.S. military convoy in Kabul on Saturday, killing at least 13 Americans inside an armored vehicle.
The president, mm-hmm. whatever, of Afghanistan, also said that he wants to back up Pakistan if there's a conflict between Pakistan and us. So he's a great, you know. Whenever I hear about Muslim allies, I always emphasize the last four letters, L-I-E-S, allies, all lies.
This is terrible. And how much of this was the fact that they probably restrained themselves from shooting this car when it was further off?
I call them the golden rules of engagement.
Or just war theory.
Yeah.
Just war theory may have played a large role in letting this happen. Now, mind you, if he's got a bunch of explosives, even if you get him when he's a bit of a distance off, but it's different from allowing it actually to run into the convoy, which shouldn't have happened. And then in Syria, we've got Assad going after his own people. I guess the resurgence in Syria have kind of, you know, basically decided that they were going to go ahead and renew their protests in light of the fact that Gaddafi was killed.
Egypt went down,
Yeah, so they figured, okay, we'll go ahead and with some renewed vigor protest Assad. Well,
so
Assad cracked down on them and killed a whole lot of his citizens again, and he's getting very defensive. People are talking about doing something with Syria, and he's warning that if you try to do something where there's going to be an earthquake, you're going to unsettle the entire Middle East. He's very self-important. He says that basically the hinge or the center of the Middle East now is Syria, so that if you destabilize Syria, that the entire Middle East is going to be destabilized.
You know, this thing about destabilization of the Middle East, they all say destabilize. You know, to go there and knock out the bad guys, it was stabilized the entire area. You know, to go into Saudi Arabia, to go into Iran, but whatever, destabilize. What a pathetic term.
Yeah, so I don't know if this is going to be yet our next war that we're going to go into. I saw a number of calls this week for people to stop the massacres in Syria. I think the Syrians themselves, what they protested, because they would like the UN to institute the no-fly zone as was done in Libya. So basically they're asking for the same
secular
type of intervention.
Similar to Saddam in that sense, where, you know, Islamic rule, Sharia law is not installed there. So if Obama does go there, it is again to make sure that these guys, like in Libya, like in Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood take hold, Sharia law takes hold, Al-Qaeda gets in there. Because, I mean, ever since Obama has become president, the Muslim world has become more Islamic.
Right, and that's what Assad says about himself, too. He says he described the uprising as, quote, a struggle between Islamism, you love that term, right, Bosch?
Yeah.
Islamism and pan-Arabism, which is secularism, adding, quote, we've been fighting the Muslim Brotherhood since the 1950s, and we are still fighting with them, end quote. So he's warning, basically, if you unseat me, it's going to be the Muslim Brotherhood, so have a nice day.
Well, then Obama's actually going to unseat him. It seems like that's his damn mission. His submission, his mission.
Everything that has been done over there has just been a disaster. And it's been for one of two reasons. Either we're over there nation building or trying to curry their favor Iraq. Iraq, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. But
safer for Islam.
Yeah, in the case of Afghanistan, we should not have been there as long as we have been.
And about the term Islamism, you want me to jump on?
Well, no, we'll talk about that later. There's actually a couple other things I wanted to do before we go to that. So the thought that I had, I lost my thought now. Okay, so one was the fact that we've been in the wrong war, or we've been conducting them the wrong way, according to just war theory or some sort of a nation-building, neoconservative nation-building philosophy. Yeah, heavy doses of altruism in there to go ahead and help build up their infrastructure so that they can go ahead and destroy it with bombs again.
We build bridges, they build them up, literally.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. So then there's that. And then, you know, on the other side, we're getting involved in places that we shouldn't be getting involved with at all and picking winners that are going to make the place more Islamic. Just another piece of wonderful good news out of the Middle East, because there's just so much of it. Saudi Royal apparently offered a $900,000 reward for the capture of Israeli soldiers.
because I didn't
just,
know that's what
just out of the blue for no reason at all, right?
Zero.
There's no apparent reason why a Saudi royal would just offer $900,000. Why
and
would he
openly,
do this? Gee, could it be because of the deal that Israel recently made
the
to
deal with the devils?
Yeah, they freed 1,027
cutthroats.
1,027 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for one Israeli soldier named Gilad Shalit. So every single Israeli soldier who is captured is, in this guy's mind, worth 1,000 of their people.
Right.
And so why not offer this huge reward? Saudi Royal offered a $900,000 reward to anyone who captures an Israeli soldier. He said on Saturday, Prince Khaled bin Talal, who is the brother of business tycoon and Fox News co-owner,
yes,
Walid bin Talal, told the Saudi-based broadcaster Al Dalil that the captive would then be released in exchange for Arabs held in Israeli prisons.
He said this openly because he knows
yeah.
he's
Khaled's
with
offer
impunity.
Comes. It says Khaled's offer comes days after the prominent Saudi cleric Awad al-Karni put $100,000 on the head of every Israeli soldier. Al-Karni's statement posted on Facebook was severely criticized. Messages posted online even warned of death threats, etc. Khaled told the broadcaster, quote, my offer also comes in response to the threats made against Sheikh Al-Karni, end quote. So it just shows you that if you negotiate with terrorists, that it doesn't work.
No.
And
but on the other side, they think terrorism does work.
Yeah, I mean they're being
we're showing them that terrorism
yeah, they're being reinforced in that. They're saying, look, you know, all I have to do is capture. Let's talk a little bit about Herman Cain, not too much. Cain is neck and neck in the various polls with Mitt Romney now. He's doing pretty well. It says he has surged to the top spot in the Iowa poll, which was published in the Des Moines Register on Saturday night, last night. And he leads Romney 23% to 22%, which is not much. But would anybody have predicted that Cain would do this well, especially without the support of the media, right?
But you know, there's no passion for Romney whatsoever. Zero.
Well, there can't be any passion for
there
Romney.
There isn't, so that's why I think Cain is...
For people who think that Romney is decent, please listen to... I had a prior podcast, which I spent an hour shredding Romney's so-called plan and telling you that it's not anything close to free enterprise or a stark departure from Obama or anything else that he describes it as. It's ridiculous. Apparently, this poll, this Iowa poll, essentially mirrors what is going on nationally. Says the former pizza executive is edging the ex-Massachusetts governor in recent surveys. In terms of the other candidates, you've got Ron Paul trailing Romney. He's at 12%, Michelle Bachmann at 8%, Newt Gingrich at 7%, Rick Perry at 7%, Santorum at 5%, and Huntsman's way down there with 1%. And I don't know whether Gary Johnson was allowed to be in this poll or not. I hate that.
Yeah, but he is. Yeah.
They should allow him to be in the poll at
but
least.
But he's the candidate who wasn't there, even when he's there.
I know, but I hate when he's not allowed in the polls.
Gone Johnson.
I don't know. It's sad. In terms of developments, there's an ad that is either a fumble on his part. I mean, we talked last week about his fumbles with regard to abortion. This week he was on Hannity. And Hannity did bring up the abortion issue, but he seemed to softball it a little bit. And even though Hannity softballed it and didn't really press it too hard, Cain seemed clearly uncomfortable. He meant to say that somebody had taken him out of context, and instead he said out of concept.
Yeah.
Which was unfortunate. He definitely seemed uneasy. He was given the opportunity to make the statement, I am 100% pro-life, period.
Right.
But he wasn't pressed on that. He wasn't asked what concrete things he promised to do about it. So I thought that was interesting. He is scheduled to have a one-on-one debate with Newt Gingrich sometime this week. And there's been some speculation as to whether he was going to pull out of that. Some people were saying that it wasn't a good idea. I tend to agree that it wouldn't be a good idea for him to debate Newt Gingrich, only because Newt Gingrich is such an experienced politician and he's pretty good at pulling the wool over people's eyes.
Yep.
Cain really respects him as being very intelligent too. So
he might defer.
Yeah, Cain would naturally defer. I don't see what Cain has to gain from this unless there's been some sort of prearrangement in advance where Newt Gingrich is going to help Kane look good, and then maybe Gingrich is going to be his running mate, or I have no idea. I just, it kind of baffles me as to why he wants to do this. I understand he'd like to get a better hearing for his ideas, but maybe the best would be to keep telling people, like he has in various debates, go read the plan for yourself. 999, for instance, he says, it's not a value-added tax. Go read what it's about and judge for yourself. So I think that is a potential misstep on his part. Will he continue to look good in the polls after the Gingrich debate? I don't know. Now, then there's the smoking ad, the so-called smoking ad. It's either...
His chief of staff.
Yeah, his chief of staff. What's his name? Brock or something?
I forgot.
Why did I forget his name? His initials are MB. It's like... It's not Michael Brock. I feel terrible now. But so he's got this chief of staff in the ad, and he's saying, you know, how great Herman Cain is. You've never seen a candidate like this, and that's why everyone, you know, he's doing so well, and people are surprised, but I'm not surprised. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think he was great, et cetera. And then at the end...
He's smoking.
On camera. And he exhales right into the camera.
And the leftist media are... There's a Tom Brokenjaw. He said he was stunned by that. I mean, as stunned as he is about the president of the United States of America being a smoker, or just...
Yeah. So you think about this. I mean, first of all,
he's a smoker.
They seem to sometimes just do things just to be different, but there's a couple different things they could be saying with that ad, right? One is Obama, yeah, he's a smoker.
We have the freedom of smoke.
But we don't ever see Obama smoking except in old pictures.
Behind closed doors.
Isn't there that old picture where he's smoking a joint or whatever? He
hides his smoke, and this guy right in the open,
yeah,
with an ad,
yeah,
you know, campaign
yeah.
ad,
yeah,
which is yeah. funny.
I think that's pretty funny,
and it made a lot of noise.
The other thing is, it could just be their symbolic gesture of rebelling against all of the anti-smoking measures that the government has engaged in. Now, I would say that smoking, unless it was done by somebody who knew he's got good genetics and it was done only in extreme moderation, is a stupid thing to do.
It is. I mean, I smoked for 7 years myself.
7 years, huh?
Yeah.
And you quit cold turkey, right?
I did. Yeah. I enjoyed it, but I said I want to live to be 100 now.
Yeah. But, I mean, in terms of the ad, I think it's really kind of cool as a sign of rebellion. I mean, you just never see somebody smoking. I laughed when I saw the ad.
It was funny. I
was happy. There are things that are likable about Kane, that he'll just do things that are off the grid like that. Of course, he gets a smile on his face when you ask him about this, but Kane is definitely a mixed bag as well. I want to see how these things play out as time goes on. There's the 999 plan, and now we've got Rick Perry with his flatter tax plan that you can either opt in or opt out.
Four and a half, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it would be nice if it was 4.5. That'd be great. And then there's, of course, the fair tax, which I believe will get rid of the income tax entirely and replace it with a consumption tax.
Which, isn't that what Kane says? Ultimately, that's...
Well, I don't know if Kane's endgame is to entirely get rid of the income tax. I think the biggest thing that these guys have to answer is the safeguard question. And the question is, it can start out at 999, for example. What's the guarantee that it's not going to go up to 10, 10, 10, et cetera? And Hannity asked Kane that question, and Kane did not give, I think, as good an answer as he had in the past, which is that Kane had mentioned in the past procedural safeguards, that the rate couldn't be raised without certain types of, like a two-thirds vote or, you know, something else that had to be overcome in order to raise the rate. So I would be nervous about it unless they put some sort of a procedural safeguard in, because I don't see yet, even though I'm very happy with the existence of the Tea Party, I think that we're either too late, such that we're going into the dark ages, or we are going to be able to continue and improve the culture through things like the Tea Party. Even though I think that's true, I think that we're going on the right path, that people are realizing what problems are out there, I'm not sure that we wouldn't take a detour back before that. And I don't want to see 999 turn into 12, 12, 12 or whatever it is. So there's that issue. I like the fact of moving towards a consumption tax versus an income tax, because then if you're going to, quote, penalize something, which is what a tax ends up doing, it's better to penalize consumption versus production. Production should be favored.
He also had a great line about the sneaker tax. Sneak attacks.
Yeah, sneak attacks.
Government sneak attacks.
He said that there's so many other taxes in our tax code, right. You know, that he was trying to eliminate those as well.
And they're trying to isolate this one, just criticize this one. But he goes, how about the rest?
The flat tax of Perry doesn't seem to save us that much because everybody's going to have to work out for himself whether...
He's trying to save his campaign.
Whether it benefits you to pay the 20% versus actually, you know, the flat 20% versus go with the existing code, which is the choice you're supposed to have. But
the
fair tax, I mean, if you can entirely eliminate the income tax and make, you know, prevent it from coming back, that safeguard is the issue. Now, the other thing that gets lost in all this discussion of which tax plan do you like and why is a point that Yaron Brook did bring up in his discussion on PJTV about this. They brought it up kind of late in the game. It's like, let's talk about this. Spending cuts.
Yeah.
Spending cuts have to be the priority. This whole thing about how we're getting taxed, it is true that for the foreseeable future, we're going to be taxed because, yes, we could tomorrow all decide that we want to limit the government to its proper functions of police, court, and military. But until then, we have to transition and we're going to have to be taxing. The most important thing for them to do is to cut departments, whole departments, and cut spending. And the one who's got the boldest plans with regard to this is, of course, Ron Paul. Ron Paul, whom I don't like for other reasons. So I would really like to see these candidates, including Kane, come up with bold spending cuts. And Kane has talked about that some, but I want to see them emphasize the spending cuts because it really is the spending that is the problem more than figuring out which way we're getting taxed. I do think that both need to be done, but there's been not enough discussion about the spending. And a 20% flat tax doesn't even sound that revolutionary to me. It sounds like it's right. too high. And I think one of the candidates had talked about capping spending at 18% of GDP, which Yaron Brook says is way too high even today for a transition plan. So these guys are wimpy as far as I'm concerned, and I think they need to put in safeguards. They need to talk about cutting spending a lot more. So that's my comments on them. Now, we have about 3 minutes or so. Let me see if we've got some comments here. We've got someone called Oscar who is saying that Herman is just human and honest about his shortcomings. Yeah, I think that too. I definitely get the sense that he's a likable guy.
Was more likable than the rest.
He strikes me as honest. Of course, I could be being, you know, befuzzled or whatever the word is.
I think he comes off that way. He just does.
We talked about what we thought of the 999 plan. And in general, I think it's good to shift towards taxing consumption versus taxing production, but there are some concerns that need to be addressed a little bit more accurately.
You know,
now, what was the other comment that I'm skipping that you think I should take a peek at?
That's fine.
Okay.
You know, the question is always, to me, is he better than Obama? It's like, well, who isn't? And then it's like, how good is he? You know.
Yeah. I really don't know. I get this sense that right now I would be able to vote for Herman Cain over Obama, but something could change between now and the end of it. I really don't want Romney.
Mm-mm.
If Romney is there, I might be tempted to vote for gridlock over Romney. I would be crossing my fingers for gridlock.
We're speaking today.
We're speaking today. We don't know.
Because we have the destructive, you know, force in the White House right now.
Yeah, there's so much that the president can do and in today's governmental structure is able to do without the approval of Congress that I really don't want Obama in there for 4 more years. I would really love to avoid that. But if I have to, I have to. So Mike says he loved the cigarette ad.
It was hilarious. It was generally funny.
Apollo here says tax policy should not even be discussed. Cutting spending should be the main concern. Yeah. He says, but the Republicans are a one-trick pony that only talk about cuts. Yeah, no, they talk about taxes. Yeah. Now we're actually a few seconds away. Mm-hmm. So what I need to do is I need to tell you guys how to keep in touch with me during the week at don'tletitgo.com. That's where you can find all the different ways to keep in touch with me, including Twitter. There's a Facebook page. If you like this show, you can come and like the page and keep in touch there. And follow me during the week. You can subscribe to the blog. watch out for a couple pieces this week. One that I hinted at is I'm going to write a piece on Steve Jobs, and I really want to emphasize the Aristotelian elements of his approach to life and his work. And then Bosch is working on a piece as well. What's yours
about? It's called Who Cares About Islam? And it's challenging the terminology war that's going on again about Islam. What is Islam? As in, is it Islam? Is it religion? Is it ideology? Is it this? Whatever. So
yeah, should we call it totalitarian Islam? Islamism?
So basically, my thing is, who cares about Islam? And you can take that question two ways.
Yeah, definitely. So watch for those pieces. They'll appear either on our blogs or elsewhere. Bosch has a blog at Faustin, FAWSTIN.blogspot.com. And mine's at don'tletitgo.com. Thanks very much. See you next week.
Take care.